You're listening to Due North, your community-driven source for local and regional news in northern British Columbia on CFIR 88.7 FM. You can hear a new episode of Due North every Wednesday to Friday morning at 10 a.m., as well as episodes of Missing Peter Zosky in Prince George, hosted by Stuart Parker every Monday at 11 a.m. We gratefully acknowledge the support of the National Campus and Community Radio Association and the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative Program. In this four-part series, I'm calling a crash course on provincial politics from the middle of the province. We will be attempting to provide a broad overview of the process and how it fits into the broader political landscape of Prince George and BC. With more warning, we might have come up with a catchier title, but here we are. Jason Morris is here today to help illuminate provincial politics in light of the snap election called by the NDP for October 24th, just a few short weeks away. Jason has been teaching political science at UMBC since 2000 and is a UMBC alumnus. He's also filled a number of other roles in the world of provincial and federal politics. Jason, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, and hello to everyone.
So let's just start from the top. What are people voting on October 24th?
Elections to political scientists like myself are like a trip to Disneyland. It's a very exciting time, but it's also a time when everything is very compressed. Like things are due yesterday and there's anxiety and panic. But what people are voting for, we could break that down into two different ways. Some very technical matters. We are selecting members for the provincial legislative assembly that will then form a government to represent us. And there's a whole bunch of laws and regulations in regard to that you may wish to touch on. But more symbolically, an election in terms of what we're voting for is literally a future direction policy-wise for a province. We're looking at the faces that we want to represent us and the ideas that we wish they would represent us for on our behalf.
And how does the provincial electoral system relate to the federal electoral system? What are we voting for in relation to federal politics?
When Canada was created way back in the year 1867, the fathers of Confederation chose to make Canada a federal system of government. And by that means we have one national government that oversees the entire country and provinces that look at regional areas. So thus we have elections at both levels. And you may have participated in a federal election not that long ago to choose representatives for the whole country. And the 10 provinces and also the 3 territories do the same thing. So we're having a provincial election just for the territorial boundaries of the province of British Columbia.
And what is the division of labor like between federal, provincial, and municipal governments?
Provincially, the governments have responsibility, going back to the Constitution, to do things to us and for us in different areas that is different from the federal government's areas, but then also municipal levels. Municipal technically falls under the responsibility of provinces, but it's also another area I could have mentioned where we also select representatives. The question is about a division of labor or responsibilities between the levels. And so, for instance, the federal government looks after mail, like M-A-I-L, and the military and some foreign affairs. Provinces look after health and social programs, education, and other areas. So a provincial election will look at this. You might also be asking, like, how to set things apart in other ways. You might be confused, and many people do legitimately get confused by when they go to do a provincial or a federal election, there could be the same names. Are you asking about that too?
Yeah, I would love to touch on that.
For sure. When most Canadians have heard of, we have Liberal Party, we have Conservative Party, we have NDP. And for sure, those political parties are ones that put forward candidates to contest elections. It just so happens that they may have organizations at the federal or national level and the provincial levels. And you might be thinking, well, I love or hate the Federal Liberal Party of Canada. that's going to impact my vote at the provincial level. I'm going to vote for or against the Liberal Party. Except, the parties represent different issues given federalism. So the federal Liberal Party looks after federal stuff. Provincial looks after provincial stuff. So for the most part, the distinction is that the political parties can share the same names but may not be connected at all. In this case, with my example, you could love the federal Liberals and hate the British Columbia ones and vote NDP provincially in any matter of permutations. The only close connection is that the New Democratic Party, the NDP, they are much more connected federally and provincially, and they will share information like membership and money and other ways to manage in terms of how they do elections at both levels.
So there's no uniformity on kind of platform or position on issues necessarily between the federal and the provincial parties with the same name.
Wouldn't it be really nice if things were just so clear cut and straightforward, we could say the Conservatives stand for this. We might even want to say they stand for the ideology of conservatism, which is great reverence for the past and traditions and values, social institutions like families, church, and even government. But the party's names do not have to correspond to the ideology. And now the second twist, as we noted, is they'll be considering federal or provincial areas. Another situation is a party could be really dominant at one level, be that provincial or federal, and be even fringe or minor, itsy bitsy teeny weeny at the different level. Federally, the Conservatives are a powerhouse of a political party, love them or hate them. In BC, it's a very small party which has trouble even attracting a small percentage of the vote.
Yes. So is there kind of a historical context for how that develops? Is there a reason some parties are so well represented federally and struggle to find a foothold provincially?
That's a really good question, and there's a few things to unpack in it. I might start by looking even more philosophically without getting into the lecture notes here, is that the Canadian society, like our peoples from all walks of life and economic backgrounds and more from so many different countries, themselves aren't uniformly connected to a particular value or belief system or ideology. And thus it would be foolhardy for a political party to rigidly adhere to one narrow set of descriptions and prescriptions for how the world is and how it should be. Thus we've had parties in terms of what they're presenting tend to be more middle of the road. A fancier term we have for that is brokerage. They're trying to broker diverse interests in society. And then, of course, Canadian views and attitudes can change. And over time, these years since Confederation, political parties have changed their tunes and altered their song sheets and changed their logos and names and colors and flags and other campaign paraphernalia, all in the interest to do what their ultimate goal is, and that's to win the offices of the institutions of government.
And what are election campaigns like in BC typically? And how will having such a short campaign period change that this year?
Right. Another good question. Typically is sometimes a word we don't use in BC politics, though it's fair for you to say. Atypical or unpredictable and also very, what's a polite term? Very fever pitched is a way that BC politics tends to go. This is often because historically and even in today, maybe you listeners can sense it, as we have this gap or divide in the political parties, as sort of one side representing business and the free market economy and what they might describe as to the right side of the political spectrum. This would be like the BC Liberals, taking turns being in power with the New Democratic Party of the province that is seen as standing up for the working class woman and man and the union person, the person that takes a lunch bucket to the office And as well, more and more the post-materialist kind of conceptions of people's interests, where the NDP is advocating for people that represent as being from the LGBTQ2 community and other such distinctions. So now we've got this so-called left of the political spectrum at loggerheads with the right. And the Donnybrook or the clash, the big battle is in the election when these two opposing forces seem to come together like it's a Mel Gibson Braveheart movie.
And so having this really short campaign period, how do you think that will influence how candidates approach getting their messaging out, developing their party platform or their platforms, and communicating with the kind of broader political landscape of British Columbia?
Unless you are volunteering for a political party or a candidate, which is always a great thing to do, to participate, you're not going to get a sense at all over the next month or less even of the scrambling and panic and late night coffees and pizzas trying to get all the ducks in a row just to contest this election. The province is carved up in 87 different ways. And you might want to ask about that down the road here, which really means about 87 mini elections are going to occur. And the political parties want to have candidates in each of those areas that then understand the local issues and that are in tune with their political party's broader campaign platforms. I think that was the second part of your question. Generally, the political parties have their proposals that they want to see implemented that they feel will catch the interest of the voting population to a significant degree. They get lots of votes, and political parties typically develop those through their membership. And pretty much any British Columbia resident, young to old, can just join a party for about $10, probably $5 or free for students, and participate in policy development, which then becomes those parties' proposals. That's a great way to participate, because you could come off the street or just be finished a class or your shift at your job and then think, wow, I just had some input in what could become policy for the province.
Yeah, you mentioned the scramble to get to a place where you can even contest the election. I know that the Green Party candidate is currently seeking signatures to validate their nomination. What's the possibility or the likelihood or the fallout if candidates aren't given the time to put those ducks in the row?
We've seen happen as well, political parties like the NDP here in BC allowing a person to be the candidate when somebody else was still contesting it in the Stikeen area. For the Green Party, as a minor party that really wants to continue punching above its weight class in BC politics, it has less money, less members, less organizational ability, and still wants to contest all of those 87 ridings and be seen as a major player, but is faced with significant challenges of getting what would be Elections BC, the legal requirements to be on a ballot so that when we go to vote by mail or in person, we can put Green Party, UNBC student, thumbs up for that, of course. One of those is getting enough signatures to prove to Elections BC that you didn't just go on Facebook or Instagram in the morning and decide to run. You can get more than just your mom or your boyfriend or partner or whatever to support you. You've got some support in the community that would permit you to get your name on the ballot. And that can be a scramble for smaller parties. Of course, there isn't much time. And of course, you want to start campaigning, which can put a smaller party or anybody in this situation at a significant disadvantage to, say, a political party that's got candidates. All they have to do is go to someone's garage and pull out the lawn signs from the last election and maybe slap a sticker on it and they're good to go.
Right. So you mentioned the electoral districts a few times. There are two that split Prince George kind of down the middle following the rivers. Why? How did that develop?
It would intuitively just make sense to have an electoral district, also called a riding, for Smithers or for Williams Lake or Fort St. James, say, Vanderhoof, you know, those neighborhoods, and also just Prince George. but that isn't the case. Electoral boundaries, that is the territory of each of these districts, are set by a nonpartisan independent provincial commission, which kind of comes up when we need to check what's going on. And then what they are aiming to do is to try to seek within a margin of error a situation in which each of these electoral districts are set up so that when you or I, anyone goes to vote, our vote is roughly worth or equal the same amount. And that we're not, say, in a situation of a place like Surrey, which I believe is about the fastest growing municipality in the country, where there's so many people there that your vote is not worth as much as somebody that might live in Fort Fraser or Fraser Lake, where there's much fewer members. So coming finally around to your question, thank you, is Prince George itself is carved up so that outlying communities can get enough people in the electoral district to have a roughly equal value for their vote. And as well, I'll add to this now, so that the size territorially of the electoral districts is not so obscene that it's impossible to navigate.
Is there a risk of conflating the interests of people who live in Prince George with those who live more rurally in the outlying areas under this system that kind of divides along numerical boundaries?
It must be a real challenge for the victors of elections to try to treat all of those that voted for them, and as well those that did not, fairly and responsibly. Since we're in a campaign now, the candidates have to go around to all of the communities and show that they understand and value the opinions of the people they would like the support from. Of course, you can't please everybody. They won't always be successful. When you think of the party's policies, going to a community that supports clear-cut logging is not going to work. Say if you're a Green candidate and you're just going to have to, you know, explain your position the best you can and be fine with that. But at the end of the day, the voters are going to make choices not just on policies, but on a whole bunch of other issues too.
And in the process of renegotiating those ridings, which happened 2008, I believe, there were quite a few added to the Lower Mainland and a few removed from the kind of northern region of the province. Has that had an impact on how the North is represented or how people feel they're represented in the provincial legislature?
British Columbia's political culture certainly has this urban-rural divide. How about south and north divide too, mostly, but the interior as well. It just so happens by history and trade and commerce and other factors that the majority of the population is concentrated in a small area, mostly the Greater Vancouver, Lower Mainland area, the southern tip of Vancouver Island. That's where the people are. That has great political impacts. Since we carve up electoral districts according to where the people live, it stands to reason that those highly populated areas essentially get to send more members of the Legislative Assembly to the capital city in Victoria. Next, it's fair to say that you could be somebody that lives in New Hazelton and figure you're not really getting ably represented. If there is an issue about the tolls of bridges along the Fraser River in Greater Vancouver, that's going to be much more focused on by virtue of how many seats in the population is there. You're going to get left out. One thing that provinces don't have is a bicameral legislative system, and that's just a fancy term for having a legislative branch that's got two parts, and one represents people by their population distribution, and the other could represent regional, mm-hmm. like Canada's Senate. Provinces don't have that. What it means is any government, any political party campaigning is going to have to show that it is not just catering to a certain area of the province, or they're bound to face some political pushback.
So the specter of the U.S. election looms large, even here in Canada. There's a lot of talk about gerrymandering and that kind of manipulation of electoral districts. Is this something that BC has experienced in the past, or people mm-hmm. should keep an eye on?
I love the term gerrymander. It's fun to say out loud, isn't it? It's a term that refers to when there is political manipulation of the boundaries of an electoral district to give an advantage to the redistributor. And yes, BC has, unfortunately, a history of that. An example that comes to mind would be when the social credit government was in power. This would be, I imagine, Bill Vanderzam would be the premier, so we're going back a few generations now. But one of the members was named Grace McCarthy, and a little bit extra area for her was carved out, which became known as Gracie's Finger, where she had a strong pocket of support. Since that time, the Electoral Boundaries Commission works pretty hard to solicit public opinion, but also expert opinion, including population data and geographic data, to make sure that gerrymandering is a thing of the past. It's still going to come up again, but BC has moved on from being a very ad hoc and informal process to quite a rigorous system. It's also buttressed by Canada-wide Supreme Court of Canada decisions that have set out how to do electoral boundaries population-wise.
So why do you think people should vote in this election? Why should people care about this election, maybe not instead of, but as well as the U.S. election?
Maybe people will feel a little bit of a burnout thinking of the U.S. election, which dominates even our CBC headlines for our own country. And then you get stories later on about provincial matters for the election, and you might not hear anything about your local area. People will also say, well, if you don't vote, you can't complain. You hear that a fair bit, too. You could instead argue that voting is a precondition of democracy, and it's one of the ways that we play a part in civic life. With all of the divisions that we have economically, socially, politically, October 24th is still a really special way where we can all do something that we agree on. Not in terms of our choices on the ballot, but something collectively as voting. Why should you vote? Governments as well spend a whole lot of our money. Something like near half of every dollar of taxes goes to healthcare. Who isn't concerned about the sustainability or the improvement of a public healthcare system? Not voting means you're forfeiting to some degree some ability to have some input in how such a huge social program, which occupies a big part of the Canadian and provincial identity, how it operates and how it continues to be. I'd also have to say we do get with fixed election dates, except for this time, like 4 years notice of when an election is. So yes, we are all busy. We have classes and jobs and relationships to maintain and nurture and so on, not to mention hobbies, but we got a lot of notice for when this was coming up, and we can even mail in our ballots now. We barely have to take off our bunny slippers and our PJs to go and vote. It's not that big of a deal.
Is there anything specific about this election that you think might motivate people or should motivate people to vote?
Of course, what is going on right now is a pandemic, which makes this an unusual election. And so far, the first part of the campaign has been mostly people and political pundits asking, why now? Why have an election? We had a prime minister just recently say we're in a second wave of a pandemic. People asking, if we can't have Thanksgiving, if you had to scale down that all those uncles not coming to your weddings because of restrictions, why can we have an election? And we will have to see, time will only tell if it was a good or a bad time to have an election. I guess on the flip side, I would argue that population health certainly matters for COVID-19, but so do elections and finding governments that can continue to tend to provide leadership on such a serious matter as this, but many others.
And to finish off, Could you maybe tell us a story from your many years engaged in the political system, perhaps from the campaign trail, that really illustrate for you the importance of campaigning in political politics?
One of the hardest jobs when you're campaigning for a candidate is door knocking. And now, who knows if that's even going to happen so much? But you are given a whole bunch of streets and you spend the whole day knocking on doors and hoping the people don't like shoot you or throw something at you. You also hope they are wearing clothes, which has seemed to be a problem that many have experienced. And it is exhausting. And it is an area in which you always have to have your smile on and be polite and cordial, even if you're down in the dumps or a little depressed or need some coffee that day. But at the end, when you're back in the campaign office, having knocked on doors, and I think I've knocked on just about every door between Vail Mount here, almost near to Smithers in my younger days, you feel such a great sense of not personal accomplishment or ego, but really connection to the community that you live in. And yes, you might get stuck at someone's door or getting invited in for tea and wind up looking through old photo albums of grandnieces, but you've also seen how British Columbians, how Canadians are living, what they're thinking about, what they're caring about, and ultimately you can generalize to what they feel is a vision for the future direction of the province for them and for the people that they really, truly care and love.
Great. Jason Morris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so here's my read on the world of BC provincial politics. First, provincial politicians and provincial policies are exceptionally relevant right now. Things like healthcare management, schooling, social and environmental policy all fall under the case file of provincial politicians. Think pipelines, fracking, Indigenous land and sovereignty, COVID directives are provincially decided. Same as school openings and healthcare budgets. Second, the political leanings of the parties of the same name that operate federally are not necessarily aligned. So, if like me, you're thinking to yourself, how interesting that there is no conservative capital C candidate in my seemingly very conservative riding, that's because there is probably a conservative lowercase c candidate that is ideologically aligned with the right. It seems to be that provincially the Liberals occupy the right side of the political spectrum. Reading from right to left, with the center point somewhere in there, in order, are the NDP, Greens, and the newly formed Eco-Socialists. Third, smaller and less established parties are significantly disadvantaged by a shorter campaign period. In fact, smaller, less established parties are at a significant disadvantage in elections generally, and may be disadvantaged right out of the running by the snap election. So even if you don't plan to vote for the candidate, consider signing their nomination forms. Democracy and representation are stronger, of course, when candidates are not a shoo-in, and parties are held to account by the possibility of being voted out next time round. Fourth, the ridings are not intuitive, and this has an inevitable effect on who gets elected. Having a constituency with such a broad range of interests and concerns makes difficult work for politicians. Does it encourage centrism and catch-all politics? Perhaps. Fifth, there are barriers to voting that Professor Morris and I skimmed over, including homelessness, immigration status, having a criminal record, inability to take time off work or childcare, language, and so many others. These are important and absolutely do have an impact on how our democracy functions. How can we trust our elected officials to represent the interests of marginally housed folks when they are so often not afforded the privilege of voting? So to clarify, apathy is not the only reason people don't show up at the polls. And there are lots of ways to practice civic engagement that are, arguably, more community-minded. Particularly, if your community is frequently excluded from the political conversation. And finally, one of the biggest things I struggle with is the mental gymnastics it takes to, on the one hand, recognize the colonial nature of our political system, and then on the other hand, believe it important to engage with these same systems. For me, it can't be an either-or situation, or it makes no sense. There are some real-world consequences to who gets elected, particularly for those of us that use social and political services like public schools, public transit, provincial parks, BC Medical Services Plan, and the childcare benefits. So if you do have the privilege of voting in the upcoming provincial election, I would suggest considering to do so. But in the long run, perhaps we should be considering the legitimacy of these systems to govern us in the first place. My name is Kate Partridge, and you've been listening to Due North on CFUR 88.7 FM. You can find us online at cfur.ca. The interview you just heard can be found at canada-info.ca. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please email the newsroom coordinator at music@cfur.ca. Our theme music is by Bad Bad Not Good. We gratefully acknowledge the support of the National Campus and Community Radio Association and the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiatives Program.